Welcome to session 6D on theology. Our first speaker is Robert Bishop, and Robert is speaking on scientific explanations are purposefully limited to natural causes. Robert is the McIntyre Professor of Philosophy and History of Science at Wheaton College. Robert?
All right. Let's see.
Robert, do you want to try the mic?
Is it on now? You getting anything with this? Yeah, I think we're going to end up using the handheld. All right, yeah, so we did our best to try to do it that way. All right, so one of the things I want to start off with is giving a just sort of, you know, kind of shout out, praise God for historians of science, not necessarily because I that's part of my portfolio, but over the last several decades, it's been historians of science who've done so much to demonstrate the positive relationship, generally positive relationship between Christianity and scientific inquiry. Without the work of historians of science, we would be pretty much ignorant of that particular relationship. And indeed, we probably would be still stuck thinking about strictly the work by White and others who gave very one-sided accounts of a kind of conflict or warfare model. Thank God for historians of science. But it's also the case that historians of science have helped us to understand that there has been, as part of that positive relationship, a form of what I think you could describe as methodological naturalism, that in essence is sort of encapsulated in my title, going back all the way to times when we used to call what we now call scientific inquiry, natural philosophy, that it has always been focused with a particular kind of limitation to try to understand the purposes of the processes and purposes of the what we now call natural causes, but in the old times would have been called secondary causes. And just a couple of examples of this, let me read a quote from historian of science David Lindbergh about Albert Magnus, from the 13th century, who was Thomas Aquinas' teacher. So Lindbergh notes that Albertus distinguished, quote, between philosophy and theology on methodological grounds, and to find out what philosophy alone, without any help from theology, could demonstrate about reality. Albertus acknowledged, with every other medieval thinker, that God is ultimately the cause of everything, but he argued that God customarily works through natural causes, and that the natural philosopher's obligation was to take the latter to their limit. Albertus pointed out that God employs natural causes to accomplish his purposes, and the philosopher's task is not to investigate the causes of God's will, but to inquire into the natural causes by which God's will produces its effect. To introduce divine causality into a philosophical discussion would be a violation of the proper boundaries between philosophy and theology. And if you move forward, people like Robert Boyle, Isaac Newton followed this same kind of distinction between natural philosophy and, or what you might call natural philosophical inquiry, and theological inquiry. But also, like Albertus, they thought that you could also put those two forms of inquiry into fruitful conversation with each other. So the idea of having distinct lines of inquiry doesn't mean that there can't be conversation and fruitful interaction between those lines of inquiry. Let me give one more example, a little bit more modern, 19th century, from Congregational minister and geologist George Frederick Wright, who in 1876 said the following, quote, "It is not in accordance with what we especially value in the modern habits of thought to cut the Gordian knot with the simple assertion, so God has made it. Such a course would be suicidal to all scientific thought and would endanger the rational foundation upon which our proof of revelation rests. It is superstition and not reverence which leads us to avoid the questions concerning the order and mode of the divine operations. We are to press known secondary causes as far as they will go in the explanation of facts. We are not to resort to an unknown cause for explanations of phenomena until the power of known causes has been exhausted. If we cease to observe this rule, there is an end to all science and of all sound sense. So the upshot of these and other examples that you can look at from the history of science are that methodological naturalism has always been a kind of purposeful limitation of natural scientific inquiry into the study of the secondary causes of God's creation. What we today call natural causes, we've left behind that sort of older term. Now, you might wonder, particularly in the context of where there's been a lot of discussion about methodological naturalism, pro and con, over the last decade or two, you might wonder, why have so many Christian natural philosophers and scientists had this kind of view? And one way in which we can get a handle on sort of what has been the motivation or the kind of line of thinking is actually given to us by the theologian Thomas Torrance. So in his book, Divine and Contingent Order, published originally in 1981, he actually gives a theological argument that captures sort of this historical line of thought for why so many theists have found methodological naturalism this sort of purpose limitation on scientific inquiry to be so compelling. And the first point he starts with is ex nihilo creation. The fact that God is the one who has made space, time, laws of nature, matter, energy, basically anything that is not God is made by God through the person of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. So the cosmos exists as a created thing, but the idea of ex nihilo creation gives us a very important payoff that was historically quite crucial to our understanding things about the relationship between God and creation, and that is that the creation itself is contingent. The nature or the kind of being that creation has is a being of contingence, contingent on divine love, divine will, divine power. Now this implies, Torrance wants to argue, that it really is the case that empirical and theoretical methods of inquiry have to be designed in such a way that they are appropriate for studying the regular, repeatable, ordered kinds of natural phenomena that the creation is basically made of. In other words, the idea, Torrance tries to drive home, is that creation's being distinct from God, being a contingent created thing, basically demands as sort of the object of inquiry an approach to inquiry that is distinctly different from theological inquiry. It has to be particularly suited or aimed at the nature of the very thing that we want to study. Right, so that's the first point. The next step in the argument that he puts forward is that created being is contingent rather than necessary. So if we understand the way in which creation as gift out of God's love has this kind of contingent sort of character to it, we also, and if it's a product of God's love, then we understand that it's not necessary that God had to create. So there's not a necessary connection between who God is and the fact that creation has a particular kind of being to it, or even that it exists. Now, one of the things that Torrance emphasizes is that we only gain this kind of knowledge, this understanding that creation is contingent via special revelation. It's not something that we get from, he thinks, from natural inquiry. And historically, the argument has been that special revelation gives us this particular kind of insight, that creation is contingent. So we also have to think about what the fact that creation is being contingent means in terms of, or what does it imply in terms of appropriate means of inquiry. So for Torrance, that means that if it's contingent order, that requires taking the properties and processes of nature on their own terms as those kinds of contingent created things. He notes at this point in his discussion that, you know, one might find it a little bit paradoxical that we seem to be suggesting theologically that you have to take something that is God's creation, but in order to understand God's creation, you have to, in some sense, focus only on that which is created, right? The properties and processes of creation. So he addresses this in the following sort of way about this kind of paradox. He says, the paradox may be succinctly formulated in terms of two classic statements of Reformed theology. First, nothing can be established about contingents except through divine revelation. And second, divine creation requires us to investigate the contingent world out of its own natural processes alone without including God in the given. In other words, this seemingly paradoxical situation that you sort of have to, instead of looking to God to understand creation, you have to look to creation, he argues, is something that's been has been central to the way Reformed theology has actually thought and argued about, biblically speaking, what is creation and how it's related to its creator. So third point as he moves on from that. So if creation is contingent and creation's contingent order is established by God, that doesn't mean that it somehow is less real than God. Indeed, he wants to argue theologically that it has full reality because it's a creation that is made the way God intended it to be made. It functions in ways that God intends for it to function. And part of the argument for why we can take that as having full, genuine reality is by looking to the Incarnation. In the Incarnation, the very Son of God actually takes on the very contingent material order of the creation that same Son of God has been the one who had made and established it, and is ultimately the one we know who will redeem and restore it. So there's something particularly important in terms of God's plans and purposes, God's love for creation, that it be this particular kind of contingent thing, and that contingent order actually has a genuine reality to it. Now, that has various sorts of implications. I'll only mention one of them that Torrance works out. If we are thinking now about the processes and properties of creation, the very sort of things that many scientists in this room and at this conference devote their time and energy to studying, if we think about that, the implication is the very sorts of properties and processes that we are studying are actually genuine actors. They really do things. Now, in some sense, that you might find that shouldn't be too surprising to you, because we live in our experience and we know that you know, processes and properties in creation actually do things. We bump into that stuff all of the time. So the first point that he wants to drive out of this is that this genuine reality is one of the things that underlies the fact that there is something that really is important for us to study. There is something genuinely there about reality that we need to be able to get a kind of handle on, but it goes further than that. There's also a connection with the idea that these properties and processes are intelligible to us. Now, maybe not that we can understand everything about creation, right, so here I could reference Jim's illustration in the plenary session about the little girl in the ocean, right? So we can understand a whole lot of things, but we may not be able to achieve any sort of practical omniscience about all of the properties and processes of creation and the very depths of what they actually mean and how everything that they actually do. But there is an intelligibility to this contingent order. So a genuine reality and an intelligibility, the natural causes in the world actually do things, and if we want to understand then what the nature of these causes are, how they act, how they interact, what they accomplish, so on and so forth, then we need to turn again to appropriate methods, and those are the empirical and theoretical methods that were developed in the period of the modern sciences that we still are working out today, because those methods are actually focused on the particular kind of characteristics of these properties and processes in creation. And then the fourth point in the argumentation that Torrance gives is that since we understand that God created freely, the universe exists as a loving, gracious act. So it's not only a loving, gracious act, but God is constantly sustaining it as this ongoing, loving, gracious act. That implies that the creation is not related to God by some form of, say, logical necessity, of which you can find many ancient views that have that kind of structure to it, immanentist views, for example. Torres thinks this is very important, and I'll give another brief quote from him here. He thinks it's important because a logical relation of, or a logical necessity between God and creation would imply that, quote, knowledge of the created world and knowledge of God would be clamped together in such a way that we would derive knowledge of God necessarily and coercively from the knowledge of the world, while knowledge of the world, even in its natural operations, would not be possible without constantly including God among the data. Right. So there's an important difference between a love relationship between creation and a logical relationship between creation. All right, so now, by way of sort of a summary then, the creator-creature, oh, I think I went one too forward. The creator-creature distinction has a particular kind of implication in terms of the fact that we have to start taking this distinction between God as a necessarily existent being on the one hand seriously versus creation as a contingent being. And the upshot here is that methods for studying nature should be designed with those particular characteristics of nature in mind. As the object of study, in other words, are the natural processes, the object of study is not God. That's what theology does. So if you go back to Albertus's the discussion of Albertus that I led off with, there you see already that kind of distinction in place. We have theological inquiry that's aimed at understanding who God is, what God's doing, and we have natural philosophy inquiry that's aimed at understanding the properties and processes of God's creation. Secondly, the incarnation implies that the contingent being of nature has been affirmed as something that has a genuine nature to it and is being sustained in a way that it has what you can call substantiality to it. And therefore, Torrance concludes, taking the creation seriously on its own terms calls for methods that focus on that contingent being. Creation was made, being made freely through divine love rather than necessity, implies that nature is not only is only properly studied using methods focusing on its properties and processes. So for Torrance, there's a kind of upshot here in terms of boiling down this focus on a kind of self, well, a sort of self-limiting focus of scientific inquiry, and that is, that's a matter of actually respect for God's creation as what God has made, respect for the genuine reality of nature's contingent being as divine gift. To do it justice, he says, we are obliged to concentrate on it for its own sake. Now, let me quickly say something about just one kind of connection between the thrust of Torrance's argument on the one hand, with one link with our contemporary understanding of scientific inquiry. Let me do that with a very quick discussion of what I'll call contextual negation versus logical negation. So a contextual negation is a case where you have hypotheses that share the same set of presuppositions that form the same context of inquiry, share the same assumptions about a particular question or problem we're trying to unravel. And it's only the principal contents of the alternative hypotheses that ends up being negated. This has a very important feature to it. It guarantees that we can construct mutually exclusive and jointly exhaustive hypotheses, and that is key to scientific inquiry. Now, the contrast here is with logical negation. Logical negation is simply a case where hypotheses are simply the opposite of each other without regard for maintaining the same set of context or assumptions of inquiry. So let me give just a quick example of that. So suppose your friend hides a cookie jar behind a screen, flips a coin. If the coin turns up heads, they put a cookie in the cookie jar. Tail, no cookie in the cookie jar. They perform that little procedure. Then they remove the screen. Your task is to determine whether or not there is a cookie in the cookie jar. Right? So simple example, but almost everything you want to say about scientific inquiry can be illustrated with this kind of simple example. Our contextually negated hypotheses are the two that I have up here. Right? There is a cookie in the cookie jar. And there is no cookie in the cookie jar. So that's a that's mutually exclusive and jointly exhaustive set of hypotheses. All right, so you pop the lid open, you look, there's no cookie in the cookie jar. Looks like you can conclude pretty easily that H2 is the correct hypothesis. But here are some other things we could consider. H3, it's not the case that there is a cookie in the cookie jar because God made it disappear. Or it's not the case that there is a cookie in the cookie jar because flying green space monkeys from Mars stole the cookie. It's not the case that there is a cookie in the cookie jar because the cookie spontaneously evaporated. Turns out you can generate an infinite number of these hypotheses because logical negation allows you to simply focus on all of the many ways in which you can negate a hypothesis. There we go. Two points to conclude. One is that scientists never follow logical negation because it simply is not possible to do any kind of theoretical or experimental work. We really do need those mutually exclusive, jointly sufficient hypotheses. Second, Torrance would argue that the hypotheses, the logically negated hypotheses I have here in yellow, would all represent ways in which we turn our focus away from trying to understand what's the nature of the properties and processes of creation to trying to understand something about God or the nature of logic or anything other than taking creation on its own terms and trying to genuinely come to its understanding. So in that sense, methodological naturalism simply is a purposeful limitation of inquiry to studying the nature of God's creation as creation, so as to know more about God as creator. Thank you.
We have our 5 minutes for questions and or transition, so go for it.
Thanks very much, Robert. A comment and a question. The comment is in the nature of a hobby horse of mine, which I dislike the phrase methodological naturalism with a vengeance, even though I practice it every day. Properly understood.
And I agree with you.
I'd like to offer, as an alternative, the simpler phrase, explaining nature naturally. That's my comment. My question, though, is I find Torrance very dense and hard to understand, and your explanation was very helpful to me, except that I didn't understand point number one. I don't understand how the fact of creation being ex nihilo leads one to conclude that empirical and theoretical investigation based on repeatability is the appropriate way to explore it. Could you somehow develop that more and explain it better to me?
Yeah, so Torrance has a lot to say about this particular point. And the link actually is to sort of turn around to what you were saying. Although I should say, and I agree with your first comment. I simply would prefer if we just talk about this. I mean, we're just talking about scientific practice. That's just what we're doing, right? So what Torrance argues, so the link goes something like this. Ex nihilo creation, which also is creation that God has purposed to accomplish particular sorts of things, must be both distinct from God, on the one hand, but also must have some kind of regular order to it that God gave. Then the question is, given that particular kind of order, what is the appropriate way to begin to understand that order? Well, we know some things about that order. It has particular kinds of regularities to it. If we want to understand those regularities, then we need methods that help us to be able to observe and then begin to peel back the layers of what is the what's the explanatory power that's given to us by those processes that gives us the regularity that we observe, and eventually new hidden regularities we can uncover, right? It's not just the seasons that we observe, but some of these more hidden things that the scientists are prying open for us time and time again.
Another question, maybe two more?
Yeah, at the beginning you hinted on this science stopper argument. So we shouldn't sort of call on supernatural explanations. But what if, say, it's only a supernatural explanation, for example, origin of life? We have been trying to find a natural cause now for decades. But if there is only a natural cause, how do we proceed here?
Yeah, so good question. So this is back. So, I mean,
can you repeat the question?
So the question is, this is related to the kind of what sometimes people say is a science showstopper. If we start to point to a divine cause, say God, for something like, say, the origin of life, then it seems like we've, the worry is we've stopped scientific inquiry. But the flip side of that is if we're, as in the spirit of what George Frederick Wright says here, we're pushing natural causes as far as they can go, what are we doing to get to the point where we've gone as far as we go and they can't explain something, right? So an example that I think, Stephen Meyer has sort of made famous, but he's not the only one, is in terms of origin of life chemistry. Right, we have all these natural causes. Then the question is, have we pushed the natural causes as far as we can go, such that now we have to talk about some other kind of cause? So I think the way that you adjudicate that is in the following, not by trying to say, I'll again use the lingo, not saying that, we need to drop methodological naturalism, because that's basically saying we're going to need to change scientific inquiry. What you do is you actually try to ask this kind of question here. Have we gotten to the point where natural science inquiry has led us as far as we can go? We need to turn to some form of agentic inquiry, like the kind of inquiry we do in the social or behavioral sciences. There's a lot of distinctly different things about that kind of inquiry versus natural science inquiry, and that really has to then be an argument about the fact that we need to move to a different form of inquiry that allows us to look at a different set of causes. Now, I will say we've often generated new scientific fields by getting actually to this point where we've exhausted all the causes we know, and now we begin to turn to ones that we don't know yet and try things, and we've created dozens and dozens of new scientific fields. So I think the way to answer that question is scientists have to come to an agreement about when have we reached sort of the end of the road on something like origin of life chemistry. I think we're probably decades from understanding where we're there or not because we know so little about it.
Okay, and we do need to stop there, so let's thank Robert.